Thank you, Rod, and it's wonderful for me to have so many brothers and sisters in Christ here, and I've enjoyed my many years of working with you and with Ray, and I have once again thank you all for all the efforts that you've made in organizing our program here, and for the many of you who have led field trips and done so much to make this a wonderful meeting, and so thank you for your kind and generous comments. It's a great pleasure to see, and I want to once again acknowledge two of our 50-year folks. And Ed Yamauchi was a mentor to me when I was in graduate school, and he and Kimi are here. And they used to hold book studies and Bible studies once a week, approximately, where we got together and studied Christian ideas together. And that was a huge and wonderful experience for me in the growth of my Christian faith, but also in thinking about how that relates to the sciences, because we studied a lot of good books together. And Joe Spradley, and I don't know whether Joe is here this morning or not, but he's been a wonderful colleague through the years. So again, I congratulate you all and thank you for your service and commitment to the ASA for all of these years. That's a real privilege for all of us to have fellowship with you and the many others of you who have come. Yesterday, as I sat through listening to one of the panel discussions, I thought, this is just great. We have a person from Canada, Heather Loy. We have a person from New Zealand, Gareth Jones. And we have several people from the U.S., but we have people from East and West, many people representing different continents here at the meeting. And that's the way that science goes, but it's also the way that we as Christians hopefully have fellowship as we think about the diversity that we bring together as we discuss ideas. Normally, I like to start a talk with a joke, but this morning I decided to tell a story. We have a science station out in the Black Hills of South Dakota, and in that area, the rainfall amounts to only about 17, 18 inches a year, whereas around here it's anywhere from 36 to 40 inches a year. This year may be an exception since we've had over 9 inches, I think, or 8 or 9 inches in July alone. But that's an exceptional year. At any rate, when a thunderstorm comes out up in the Black Hills and really rumbles around, we hear the lightning hit trees, and we've had it hit stones and even some of the buildings and different things. Sometimes it'll hit an electric circuit in the camp and it melts all the light bulbs in the sockets. I mean, we had a lot of fun experiences. I remember once lightning hit a tree just outside the women's residence hall, blew a great big hole in the ground. It was about 20 feet. We were out there a week in advance, and it broke all the glasses, the windows in the dorm, in the residence hall, and I said to the staff, you know, we got to get that hole filled and get all the glass back in there before the students arrive. And this is the kind of storm that comes. And we had a situation where lightning actually hits trees, those ponderosa pines, and it's like a torch. There's resin in those trees, and when the lightning hits it, the trees just splinter, and literally toothpicks everywhere, and the trees fall down, and then there's this huge fire because of the resin. Those volatile substances really get going. And the ranchers and the fire department, volunteer fire departments, get together and they go and they try to put these fires out because it could be devastating to the hills for a fire to be loose. So we had one of those one afternoon. Sure enough, trees on fire and rattlesnakes are rolling out of the hill because the hillside warms up and the snakes come out and you have to kind of watch where you put your feet. Well, we had a storm of that nature, and I walked up over the hill with a couple of colleagues. As I walked up over the hill, I heard students applauding like this. Walked up over the hill, and there were about a dozen or 15 students sitting on the side of the hill. And I said, what are you applauding? And the storm was receding in the northeast. There was beautiful black clouds and lightning in the distance. And they said, we're applauding the lightning. Isn't the work of the Lord wonderful? It seems to me that that's how we should approach the creation, and that's the first part of my talk. And this entire conference about synergy has to do with expressing that kind of appreciation, just an automatic appreciation. I have never since, nor in any of my experience, seen anyone else applaud lightning. I hear the stories about people being killed and buildings burning down and so on. But those students took the freedom to just stop and thank the Lord for what they were seeing. Challenges, changes, and challenges in the natural sciences. The world has a huge appetite for science, and science seldom fails to spawn simple and sophisticated advances. The scientific community faces great waves of anticipation from the expectations of the public. Science is seen as providing hope in developing complicated experiments and sophisticated technology. The public's expectations, though, do not drive the entire enterprise because scientists are following their own interests and creativity, and the advances they make follow their own gifts and training. However, the sources of funding for science and available technology dictate the directions that science will follow. We see a huge mix of interest and practice in the scientific community. The world's dependence upon science as an enterprise is truly remarkable. This is not surprising, since science and mathematics per se have engineered convenience and efficiency in such great quantities and with such life-changing developments that the pace of life is greatly affected by the degree to which science has permeated a culture. The mysteries of creation stimulate human curiosity, challenge the rational mind, they motivate sustained human investigations of nature, and inspire untold acts of compassion for good. Explorations of the vast realm of nature naturally lead to new discoveries upon which other discoveries depend or hold promise for the good of humankind and the globe upon which we live and the universe at large. Alongside and essential to the practice of science is the development of technology that scientists use to observe and record their data in their studies. Scientific studies of the Earth, all of its constituents and inhabitants, and examination of outer space are affected by immense developments in technology. Contemporary science is complex and seldom conducted by individual researchers, but many collaborators often bring interdisciplinary perspectives into the problem solving, and of course, the technology developed by engineers is key to pushing the frontiers of problem solving. Some developments of technology are to accumulate certain types of data and insights into the natural world, and some technologies are actually byproducts of larger projects where practical uses are made for everyday uses. For instance, the digital age of technology commonly used by humankind was seeded for other purposes. The development of simple telescopes and microscopes over several centuries into sophisticated instruments that can observe vast regions of the universe and great depth in molecular structure, respectively, are engineering marvels that charm and inspire the general public and inspire scientists to learn more about the physical world. Other astonishing engineering feats include communication systems, diagnostic imaging used by health professionals, or bridges that hold immense amounts of weight. This is kind of a funny concept, actually, as you take a look at this photo, I think. They traverse large expanses, among many others. One of the latest and most remarkable claims of science is to electronically link brain cells that control movement with artificial limbs and other devices. Obviously, this would provide a huge advantage to paralyzed patients. I love this bridge. I don't know how many of you have had the opportunity to go over this. How many Bostonians? Some of you recognize this. There was a wonderful sign. It took a long time to complete the huge project that was undertaken in Boston, but they had a wonderful sign down on Route 90, great big billboard for 5 or 6 years that said, if Rome had been built in a day, we would have hired their contractors. It was a magnificent undertaking, but a lot of inconvenience that went along with it. So anyway, and of course, engineers have developed amazing instruments to explore the vast realms of space within our solar system and well beyond. As we move through time, so do the efficiencies of our technology. Technology is constantly being replaced by newer technology. For over a half century, the programs at NASA have inspired us. For example, I have marveled throughout much of my life at our travel into and beyond the atmosphere of the Earth and into the broader Recently, as a nation, we have witnessed the final countdown of NASA retiring the shuttle. How did the engineers develop that orbiter, or the solid rock boosters, the external tank for the engines that overall works so well to deliver humans and cargo to explore some of the frontiers of space through observations and experimentation of the highest order? We've enjoyed some space exploration and set the pace for other countries, but we're witnessing some changes in beyond the Earth's atmosphere adventures, which have been publicly funded and are now moving into private realms for funding and development. For some time, we've been trying to buy a ticket, so to speak, and travel into space using Russian technology, or now potentially on technology like the Dragon developed by commercial space flight firm SpaceX in Hawthorne, California, which could carry crew or cargo. On other fronts, we see remarkable engineering of energy saving and other life saving and enhancing technologies. Remarkable developments in gene therapy don't take a back seat in development either, and genetics has changed the paradigms of treatment from engineering drugs to formal treatments where genetics has been found as the basis of some diseases. Alida Edwards, who is a Bainbury professor at the University of Toronto, and others from Canada with Stephen Fry at the Center for Integrative Chemical Technology and Drug Discovery at UNC Chapel Hill, and Timothy Wilson of GlaxoSmithKline, Frank Yu from Neurobiology and Dental Research in Seoul, Korea, co-authored an interesting paper in Nature in February of this year, suggesting that too many roads have not been taken where protein research is concerned, and that most protein research focuses on things known before the human genome was mapped. This multidisciplinary group from the private and public sectors says much of the work that has emerged from exploring the human genome over the past 10 years lies fallow. Challenges notwithstanding, making protein-based research tools readily available must be a major objective in the decade to come. This is a strong call for the development of more genetic probes, tools for more proteins. Only a few probes are available, and this article serves as a call for biotechnology and pharmaceutical industries to develop more tools that could drastically change medicine. The development of these probes is very expensive and calls for collaboration between public and private sectors as internationally shared development. Now, what are some of the changes in science? Things change, and science is not immune to those changes. Sometimes the change into the direction of science occurs because of policy, but most often change is driven by funding sources. One of my recent disappointments has been to watch the discussion of the funding of the James Webb Telescope. Cost escalated, but it is a premier telescope designed to explore additional frontiers of our understanding of the beginning of the universe. The Hubble Telescope, of course, has been a remarkable engineering feat. I have been following the James Webb Telescope development to the point of actually using a couple of photographs of it in our new Science Center displays. Last year, some of us were privileged to see some of the unique features of that telescope under construction when we toured the Goddard Space Lab at the ASA meeting. I actually asked Jennifer Weissman, who is a very active member of ASA, and all of you know her, and she's the science advisor, has been and is, to the Hubble telescope, if I could photograph her and the former director with one of the displays featuring the James Webb telescope. You may recall that was in the lobby there at the building. We went through that tour and saw a lot of incredible engineering things, none of which I understood, but they looked pretty impressive as we looked into those wonderful rooms where the construction was occurring. My point here is that the engineers develop remarkable technologies at a record pace, offering design based on previous and new derivation of mathematical models that inform their creative processes. The changes in funding that we're facing today are well illustrated by the debates going on in the halls of the Senate, Congress, and White House this week. In fact, this holy hour of 11 o'clock, as evangelical Christians, we think of this as a holy hour. It's also an hour when a big decision is being made in the Senate today. It's 12 o'clock out east, and they're supposed to come to some consensus, perhaps, at noon today. During this hot, very hot July, and we still see the reality of the lead title, U.S. Faces Big Chill, of an article in Nature in January of this year, which captured the mood of Congress and predicted the cold comfort we are currently facing as serious consideration is given to the current spending cuts that embattle the government, the U.S. government, now. One of the changes that we have observed is in the funding for what many of us call pure research. And I'm not sure, I've wondered for years what impure research is, but that's beside the point for this talk. Scientific exploration as knowledge for the sake of knowledge builds an extensive inventory or universal library of facts which connect to other facts over time. Our knowledge for the spectra of light, for instance, has led to the development of many technologies where visible and invisible light are used extensively for improving health and efficiencies in daily life. The huge collections of genetic data are seeding the development of new and wondrous cures of diseases and insights into life and the development of organisms. The road of working on Alzheimer's disease is a good example of where progress has been made, but significant advances are essential to untangle the complications of this disease. The discovery of the facts also directs usage of knowledge as a means to an anthropocentric end, such as the discovery of the means of preventing and treating diseases or ensuring that water is clean for populations. And water is a big issue. Many think that water will be the basis for the next war beyond the war for oil. And it may come even before we decide the war on oil. Water is so important to the existence of humans and other life on Earth. And there are many scientists. This is Jeff Greenberg, in Kosovo, I believe, working on water and distributing water into a village where clean water is not available to them. Discovery is an intellectual pursuit in humans that starts early in development and persists as well-developed curiosity throughout life. It involves exploration of very simple phenomena and testing of conditions. Many scientists enjoy a propensity for scientific discovery through observations, experimentation, and theory formation. And here, one of our faculty, Kristen Page, works in a lot of places, but she's with one of our hunger interns who goes out into two third world countries. She's in Africa there, and they're working on an ecological project there. But she's also done some work that has redeeming qualities in terms of the health of children. These beautiful little raccoons, whom we see scamper around at night, they are nocturnal, carry a parasite in those wonderful-looking worms that you see on the right. And that parasite, it has a life cycle with alternate hosts, but when it gets into children, if a child, for instance, plays on a playground where the scat of the raccoons is present on, say, a slide or a merry-go-round or something like this, and they rub their eye, they can pick up this parasite, and it causes blindness in children. This is very prevalent in this county and in other areas throughout the Midwest. It has not spread entirely throughout the U.S., but she is one of the world specialists on this disease. As a Christian, she's very concerned about the children and about breaking up this life cycle so that children won't be affected by this disease. So if you have children, they're playing on the playground, be sure that they wash their hands when they come in for good, very good reasons. And there are other reasons as well. They dedicate their God-given ingenuity, talent, energy, and wisdom to exploration of the frontiers of energy and matter on Earth and throughout the universe. Scientist studies encompass the exploration from the center of the Earth to distant stars. You probably recognize this brother, Steve Mosher. Scientists are avid explorers who want to know more about the universe. The outcomes of scientific investigations provide new insights into the world and how it works. Much of the work of scientists leads to understanding that human intervention can work for the good or ill as residents of the earth. You recognize Rod here. Regardless of the intent of the discovery, the natural outcomes of scientific investigation by Christians include the delights of worship and praise of the Lord for his goodness, for his character, and his glory as expressed in his beautiful and elegant creation. Additional expressions of delight and discovery inspire compassion for many to use the knowledge they have developed in science to help others in the plights of disease, impoverishment, and in malnutrition, among many other works beneficial to humans and creation. So, where on the earth do we practice science? Is it a placeless phenomenon? David Livingstone has given us some interesting thoughts in his wonderful book, Putting Science in Its Place. He reminds us, and you already know this, that science inquiry takes place in highly specialized sites. He says in high-tech labs, in remote field stations, museum archives, and astronomical observatories. It has also been pursued in coffee shops and cathedrals, in public houses, stock farms, on ships' decks, and exhibition stages. And yet the knowledge that is acquired in these places is taken to have ubiquitous qualities. Scientific findings, to put it another way, are both local and global. They are both particular and universal. They are both provincial and transcendental. He goes on to say, to ask what specific locations have in the making of scientific knowledge and trying to figure out how local experience is transformed into shared generalization is, I believe, to ask fundamentally geographical questions. So says Livingstone. David goes on to develop his book, suggesting that many have thought of science as an enterprise untouched by local conditions. It is a universal undertaking, not a provincial practice, according to Livingstone. By the way, I heartily recommend this book to you. So if we use his logic, it stands to reason that science conducted in Chicago is not like unlike science that's conducted in Vancouver or Wellington or Sydney or Beijing or San Jose or Cape Town. Geographers have conceded that the diffusion of scientific discoveries and technical innovations could be charted over time and space, but the origin of those discoveries are not necessarily limited in geography. Livingstone suggests, though, that the modern invention of the laboratory was a conscious effort to create a placeless place to do science, a universal site where the influence of locality is eliminated. He says that the credibility of placelessness and the triumph of the laboratory as the site par excellence of scientific plausibility since the middle of the 19th century bears witness to this prevailing conviction. David Livingstone challenges these presuppositions, though, and says that space is also important to the scientific enterprise, especially the three dominant geographical motifs of science, region, and circulation. Issues of space, he says, and here they are, location, place, site, migration, region, are at the heart of the scientific endeavor. Economic, political, social and cultural circumstances affect resource distribution across the face of the earth. Likewise, humans inhabit non-material spaces like intellectual, social, and cultural spaces. All of these spaces, that is, the intellectual, social, and cultural spaces, shape how the scientific enterprise progresses. So, hence, we have a reason to ask questions about funding and how the culture affects how funding takes place. This imaginative universe of intellect, space, and culture, says Livingstone, is gaining familiarity with the local customs of the boardroom or the library. The advent of efficient and fast communication systems that transform networks and huge storage capacities of computers adds another dimension to the discussion of geography and science place. So a huge change has occurred in communication, where scientists can speak and share data in just a few moments. So how, then, do scientists think about geography and the role that it plays today? Is there a separation of generational understanding in the role of geography in the way that science is practiced? I suspect there is. So what are some of the changes that are occurring in science, and what are some of the challenges? Now, I've put 8 things here, and I'm going to take them one by one. So if you haven't read this, and I'm not going to let you read it, sort of, I want you to know that I'm going through 8 things, and we'll take them one by one here. The first is, science is very complex, and legitimate research is conducted by teams of scientists who may be in different geographic locations. Yes, today scientists are faced with the complex nature of science, its culture, the cultures in which it exists, interpretations of science, and support for science, among others. The changes that have occurred in science are immense, from sophisticated technologies that now provide data from things that we see only with instruments, or from mathematical derivations that propose universes that we've never known, or from gene therapies once thought to be only science fiction, or from fast cosmopolitan forms of communication that allow us to know the secrets of the universe as soon as they're discovered, or modeling complex systems. The list goes on. And the current accomplishments in the sciences, engineering, and mathematics have no match in human history. Some of the challenges of the complexity of science have to do with resource allocation, efficiency of time spent at the bench or in the field, and the competitive nature of science in the processes of resource allocation, review of grants, and papers for publication. Number 2. And for those of you who went on the tour in our new science facility, I talked about this a bit, but the architecture of science facilities is pushing new frontiers of transparency and flexibility, with inviting space that spawns the creativity of individual and teams of collaborators. We're just one example in a whole trend of architecture that's taking place in this nation and abroad. No doubt you've been amazed at the places where you have seen and where you have conducted science and engineering. And I'm going to feature this just a little bit for those of you who didn't get there. Some excellent work has come out of terrible-looking labs, and some of the most beautiful labs also have poor levels of productivity, although neither is necessarily the case. There's a tendency among the progressive architects and planners, though, to move this country to develop transparent and flexible spaces, spaces that attract excellent scientists or students, and flexible space to adapt to the rapidity with which science changes in our nation. This architectural break with the older, more saltbox-like pre-Sputnik era of architectural design reflects our country's response to the Cold War tactics. Science space is being designed with attractive venues for workers and the students of science. Number 3, the supply of PhDs in science exceeds the demand. One of the most visible changes in science today is that of the PhD pool. For the journal Nature to run this as a cover article in April signals the significance of the debate about the traditional PhD. An editorial in this issue of Nature suggests that the PhD is no longer the guaranteed ticket to an academic career, and that the PhD system needs to be rethought. Joining the academic elite community of science usually involves completing the PhD. It is a key that opens many doors of opportunity for meaningful jobs, research, publishing, travel, and a comfortable lifestyle. The number of PhDs is increasing at a rate that far exceeds the jobs available for them to fill. David Cyanosky and his co-workers in the Nature article, The PhD Factory, say that the number of doctorates earned each year grew by nearly 40% between 1998 and 2006 to some 34,000 in countries that are members of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. Most of the countries are building up their higher education systems because they want to see educated workers as a key to economic growth. But in much of the world, science PhD graduates may never get a chance to take full advantage of their qualifications. And when you look at this, take a look at China with 40% growth since 1998. And you'll notice that the U.S. is not on this chart. I'm not sure why they chose not to put the U.S. Oh, yeah, I did. I'm sorry. Yeah, you are correct. Back over here, sorry, I was thinking of it in another context. But you see that the growth has been immense. But even in Poland, this is post-communist era, has grown by 6.1%. But look at Hungary and the Eastern Bloc, minus 2.2%. So there's some pretty interesting trends going on in this whole development. They go on to say that in some countries, including the United States and Japan, people who have trained at great length and expense to be researchers confront a dwindling number of academic jobs and an industrial sector unable to pick up the slack. Supply has outstripped demand, and although a few PhDs end up unemployed, it's not clear that spending years securing this high-level qualification is worth it for a job. In other countries, such as China and India, the economies are developing fast enough to use all the PhDs that they can crank out and more, but the quality of the graduates is not consistent. Only a few nations, including Germany, are successfully tackling the problem by redefining the PhD as a training for higher-level positions and careers outside of academia. The study published in Nature is a formidable one and very enlightening as we think about science in the global context. If you take a look at the rise here in China, dropping off just a little bit here in Japan, United Kingdom, and then Germany sustaining and gently rising. They are a nation to watch, but there are people that are having cautions about this. So what is happening in Germany, considered for a couple of decades to be the largest producer of PhDs in science? They have redesigned their doctoral programs during the past 20 years and moved from training students to follow their mentors' footsteps to one where the PhD is actually marketed as advanced training for academia and other career paths, the best of the best, they say, for a wider workforce. The German universities are playing a bigger role in recruiting students and developing students in the skills of writing and other transferable skills. Only 6% of their PhDs go into full-time academic positions, while the rest find jobs in industry. Some Europeans worry that Germany's strategy may slow the number of doctorates, while China and India, among others, are increasing in the number of doctorates. So, what is the status of PhDs in the United States in terms of supply versus demand? United States, according to Sinosky's group, is second only to China in awarding science doctorates. And that's overall doctorates, not just in science. It produced an estimated 19,733 in the life sciences and physical sciences in 2009, and the number continues to go up. These authors emphasize the need for the U.S. Congress to create jobs for the PhDs as well as the supply chain. They say the proportion of people with science PhDs who receive tenure is declining, and industry in the U.S. cannot absorb them all. Hans Saltzman, a professor of public policy at Rutgers University, says that more people are taking jobs that do not require doctorates, and some potential students are not undertaking PhDs. But there is an influx of foreign students. Henry Sauerman at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta says that academic research is the top career choice in the 2010 survey of 30,000 science and engineering students and postdocs. Half of all the science and engineering PhD recipients graduating in 2007 had spent over 7 years working on their degrees, and more than one-third of the candidates never finished the doctorate at all. So we see here then, if you look at disciplines, look at medical and life sciences in red, and the number is going up. Biological sciences in green, physical sciences with this grayish blue, and the social sciences keeping a fairly steady but improving in the number of doctorates that are being awarded. Time to completion. The earth and atmospheric and ocean sciences have peaked and are moving down. Physical sciences, got a pretty steady flow here, and then the biological sciences are fairly flow, same in terms of completing within about 7 years. Employment of doctorates, though, take a look at this. Medical and life sciences, look at the red. Then take a look at the social sciences. And then physical sciences, and here the green with the biological sciences. So we do have a glut of degrees and sort of nowhere for these folks to go unless they have an in. Now, that's not to discourage people from doing the PhD. We are still trying in our baccalaureate origins, as a baccalaureate origins of PhDs, encouraging students to go on to do the PhD. In fact, we're ranked 22nd in the nation by NSF as the origin of PhDs and students who go on. But this is an interesting trend. What are those folks going to do when they get out? How long will they delay by taking long periods of postdocs, and then what will they do in go into? Now, Allison McCook has looked at some suggestions in another article called Rethinking the PhDs and Some of the Dilemmas, and she suggests that it either be fixed or overhauled or skipped completely. So she says that, and I'll go back and go over these, but you either jump in the deep end, you forget academia, you trample the boundaries, get it online, or you skip the PhD. If you jump in at the deep end, PhD programs should admit only the best students. And one of the things that she has researched is the fact that some students who are doing the PhD are not as qualified as others. They're not as creative, and perhaps there should be more selection going on as these students go on to enter programs. Forget academia is another option that she brings, and she said you can take advantage of the professional science master's programs, and there are more of those being developed by the universities, as a way to stock the ranks of industry. Now, getting a master's in a specialty of that sort, where, say, a science is related to business, actually limits students' opportunities, because they are sort of locked into that specialty, and they don't have as much flex room to go into other types of careers, but that's one way to think of how to manage the education system. Another is to just trample the boundaries and go beyond the interdisciplinary approaches and really go transdisciplinary. That is, in training PhDs, train them to have the equivalency of math and physics and engineering at the same time. It's not just interdisciplinary approaches, but really give them a substantial background to do the transdiscipline work. Or get it online. Take PhD courses online and discuss the issues with professionals online. For most of us, that's not the primary way that we like to interact with our students, but this is a trend that's happening. Or skip the PhD. A highly skilled scientist, she says, do not need PhDs or get experience, and sometimes they delay the PhD until later. So people go into industry and then come back and do the PhD once they've settled into a field that they really enjoy. Big problem. Four, changes have occurred in the sources and amounts of funding to support science and engineering. Scientists, engineers, and mathematicians share a joy of discovery and understand the culture of funding. That culture is understood as competitive, and the sources of funding are scarce and derived from public and private sectors. Corporations often have foundations which provide research funding, and some organizations use education and research as their primary goals. Things like the American Heart Association, for instance, or the American Cancer Society, and you could go on with a number of those smaller enterprises, though, that do fund some research. Approximately two-thirds of research conducted in industry and between occurs and generates about 10 to 20% that's generated by universities and the governments. The United States spends as much on military R&D since 1980 and has dropped about from 30 to 20%. Foundation research focuses on applied types of research rather than knowledge for the sake of knowledge, generally, and very little knowledge for the sake of knowledge or blue sky developments are funded through foundations or government now, except in certain areas that are focused where people can follow that blue sky in their respective fields. This represents a major change in research over the past 50 years, and research has become more directed to problem solving and is more applied. A good example is that escalating cost of the James Webb Telescope, and the debate is occurring over not only this project, but many other projects in NASA, and it's led in the agency that has led in space exploration. Now, the information in this chart, and I'm worried you may not be able to see it, but I'll go up to the top in just a moment. It's from many sources, including main science and technology indicators over the years. The federal government and Wikipedia put this chart together, and I checked the sources on it, and they are accurate. Most developed countries show total research funding between 1.5% and 3% GDP. Sweden exceeds that rate in most of the countries in the developed world. So if we take a look at Sweden down here, we see that their percentage in research of the GDP is about 3.95. The U.S. is 2.68. If you go on down, China is about 1.23 and so on. So who funds this? If you look at, and these figures don't add up to 100%, and that's because there are other factors that are influencing the way these percentages worked out. There are other sources, but these are the main ones. The private sector funds in the U.S. about 64%, the government about 31%, and these funds, along with a few others, are distributed in industry to 70%, academia 13%, and into the government about 12.2%. If you look at, say, China, you would see here that in comparison, the percentage in industries about 66, similar to the U.S., in academia about 10.2, and about it's more funded, distributed into the government funds to, and there's a different type of control that occurs there. It's a very revealing chart in terms of putting various sources together to look at how funding is distributed in the U.S. And this is one of the changes that we're seeing. We are seeing a number of things that are tightening down, for instance, on government funding and also private funding in our economic crisis. One of the historic changes we observe is the move from individual scientific investigations of the 16th, 17th, and 19th centuries to a monumental shift of large research teams who bring interdisciplinary approaches to science and the large budgets required to conduct sciences. An interesting article by Daniel Creasy entitled Pfizer slashes the R&D captures some of the most current drug maker changes. As patents expire, revenues become more exposed to competition from generic drugs. Creasy cites Pfizer's change to slash its research by billions and to cut thousands of jobs. He cites the deterioration of the strong links between the drug industry and academia in Britain, for instance, and says this is evident with Pfizer's cuts on top of the job cuts announced already by GlaxoSmithKline, AstraZeneca last year. Pfizer is actually dropping its research on allergy and respiratory disease, and it will focus on neuroscience, oncology, vaccines, cardiovascular and inflammation treatments. An historian of the pharmaceutical industry, Judy Slynn, says that the pharma industry is deciding its core capabilities are actually marketing and dealing with regulatory bodies. They will still do the development work, but they're not going to do the discovery. They're moving away from the discovery part of this, and they are shipping it out to industry and also to the universities. Just Friday of this week, I was taken when I got back to the office Friday night. The Chronicle of Higher Education lead article was entitled Big Pharma Finds a Home on Campus. And they're addressing this trend as well. And when it gets down to the Chronicle of Higher Education, it's pretty much in the culture because the journals, the science journals, are way ahead in terms of announcing this. The author touts the new economy in drug discovery, which is occurring on campuses, not in the pharmaceutical companies. In this article, Vanderbilt University has a superior lab for pharmaceutical research related to Parkinson's disease and some other diseases. Okay, a fifth trend. We need to address science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education at all levels in the U.S. Education endeavors not only to create excellent scientists, but also educate citizens about the value of developments and the use of a need for research in science. Science literacy among non-scientists is appallingly low. Ask any teacher of science or scientist who engages with peers from other science disciplines. Do any of you not know that? I'm convinced that the science curricula offered at all levels, K through 12, baccalaureate, graduate, as well as research opportunities, afford special occasions for students and well-seasoned science to engage the joy of discovery and develop the skills commensurate with practice of accurate and trustworthy scientific investigation. The natural sciences and mathematics offer wonderful worlds of exploration through guided learning. Students mentored and trained in the analytical nature of experimental and theoretical science lift the intellectual capability and capacity of any community. The perception is that the majority of the secondary school students do not meet proficiency standards in science and mathematics, says Jeffrey Quincy, a specialist in education policy who works with the Congressional Research Service and creates a report to Congress that addresses the math and science achievement of U.S. pupils. The Congressional Research Service reports that among the 40 countries participating in a 2003 program for international student assessment called PISA, the United States ranked 28th in math literacy and 24th in science literacy. In the same study, the U.S. ranks 20th among all nations in the proportion of 20-year-olds who earn degrees in natural sciences or engineering. The problem in student literacy may be related to an inadequate supply of qualified teachers, improperly or inadequately trained teachers, among many other things, including other things like student inabilities, students' aversion to science and mathematics, and student drive and creativity. The number of post-secondary degrees awarded in science, technology, and engineering and mathematics has historically remained at about 17% of all post-secondary degrees awarded. And biology and computer science have exceeded this. Now, as a dean of sciences, both social and sciences, that's the mark that I set. That's the benchmark that I hope we can reach at Wheaton again, 17% of the student body. To be natural scientists. We're a little bit lower than that, but the way our recruitment is going now, I think we'll do it because that's the way the national average is for post-secondary students, 17%. And so that's where I set some of my thinking in terms of recruitment. And the faculty, of course, have a rich role in doing that recruitment. Although the revelations of the deficits of science education and performance in the U.S., various STEM education programs have emerged, and competitions were developed to disseminate funding to projects designed to draw students into and for them to develop competencies in science and mathematics. The most recent CRS report indicates that although the most recent National Assessment of Education Programs results shows improvement in U.S. pupils' knowledge of math and science, the larger majority of students still fail to reach adequate levels of proficiency. For instance, since 1969, the NAEP assessed students from both public and non-public schools at grades 4, 8, and 12, and three levels of competency were established, basic, proficient, and advanced, basic, proficient, or above. And if we look at the 15-year time frame from 1990 to 2005, we see that although the proportion of the fourth and eighth grade students achieving the proficient level above has been increasing each year slightly, the overall math performance in these grades has been basically much lower at that proficient level. The results among the 12th grade students actually are a little more mixed, although the percent scoring at the basic level is higher among these students than among the 4th and 8th grade students. The percent scoring proficient actually is smaller. So what about the teachers of math and science? Not just the students, but the teachers. A 20-year study conducted by Michael Allen shows that among those who teach math and science, having a major in the subject taught has significant positive impact on student achievement. Many math and science teachers lack this credential. The Schools and Staffing Survey is the only national representative survey that collects detailed data on teachers' preparation and subject assignments. During 1999-2000, there were just under 3 million teachers in U.S. schools, about evenly split between elementary and secondary levels. Get this, 13.7% reported math as their major teaching assignment, and 11% reported science as their main teaching assignment. Of these, 99.7% held at least a baccalaureate degree, and most had come from state teaching, had a state teaching certificate at the time of the survey. U.S. Department of Education statistics show that among the middle school teachers, 51.5% of those who taught math and 40% of those who taught science did not have a major or a minor in these subjects. That's appalling. I find that appalling as a science educator. By contrast, few of those who taught in high school, that is grades 9 through 12, math or science, lacked an undergraduate or graduate major in the minor of that subject. Among the high school teachers, 14.5 who taught math and 11 who taught science did not have a major or a minor in that subject. So in other words, 86% did, or 89% did. So the secondary ed teachers are much more well prepared for this. So if you take a look at this, look at the various disciplines, teachers lacking a major or minor in the subject taught, when you come down to science, and you see this in middle school and you see it in high school, this is lacking. There's quite a challenge out there for us as we think about secondary education and so on. What about post-secondary education? How many science, technology, engineering, and mathematics degrees are awarded in the U.S.? Post-secondary degrees more than doubled in between 1960 and 2000, that is in 40 years. However, in proportion to the degrees in all fields, the number of STEM degrees decreased in the U.S. The U.S. actually ranks near the bottom in the proportion of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics degrees. It actually ranks behind Japan and China in the absolute number. Now, I did have some comments about funding of STEM programs and so on, but I think I'll skip those and move on to one other. This is the STEM funding proportions here. NSF education gets 23%, Health and Human Services, Department of Transportation, NASA, and so on. Funding, this is 2006 by agencies. And there are some wonderful statistics in the Nature Publishing Index. You can look it up online, and I'm going to skip that part of the talk, except to say that in the top 50 schools, obviously Harvard is at the top, and if you look at this internationally, 33 of the top positions in the world are in the U.S. So we have great capability in the U.S., and some of you are probably looking for your alma mater there. There, Asia has great representation here with five schools, and four of them are in Japan and one is from China, but that's going to change as the next set of data come in. Okay, number six, the glass ceiling. Attention given to gender gaps is productive but cannot be abandoned. And the same is true for the hiring of minorities. Gwyneth Zykeve reports in Nature in February of 2011, this year, an analysis of the U.S. universities conducted by NSF revealed that less than 30% of the PhDs in the physical sciences were awarded to women. At the full professorate, where only 10% of the full professorships are found in physics-related positions. Stephen Ceci and Wendy Williams at Cornell University looked at 20 years of research and found a closing gender gap and balance in journal reviewers, granting agencies or hiring committees. They conclude that women lag behind their male colleagues in professional advancement because of a broader set of societal realities. Most of those issues related to external factors of family formation and child rearing and motherhood makes women less likely to choose research careers than male scientists. And so the point of all of their discussion really is, and this is a woman working out at Fermi Lab, too rare a sight, the title says, working on a neutrino experiment at Fermi Lab. She's one of the 10% working in physics. The bottom line is that the things that have been put in place to help attract women and minorities shouldn't be dropped. We haven't reached the point where this population is flooded with women, and that we should keep those things in place to help attract and keep women in that scientific workforce. The seventh is academic honesty. Increasingly, we are observing academic dishonesty in the halls and labs of science. It goes without saying that the members of the ASA are acutely aware of who we are and who we represent. There are moral bounds to our manipulative and intrusive examinations of nature and how we bear responsibility to God for the manner in which we treat His creation and the way we present it. So that's an important thing for us to keep in mind as Christians. And then, number eight, the big questions of faith and science deserve well-seasoned answers. Huge questions emerge at the interface of science and faith. Why did God create the world? How did God create the world? Does being created in the image of God have anything to do with the way we think about the world? How did humans originate? What's the significance of an historical Adam and Eve? Do humans have free will? And the list goes on. Are embryos humans? Do scientists have a responsibility to provide clean water to impoverished populations, and so on? So my point here is that we should answer these questions in a seasoned way where we bring both science, theologians, biblical scholars, philosophers to help us, where each one lends perspectives to these discussions. And regrettably, many people take great care to provide personal feedback without considering questions of import of the larger picture before considering the broader scope and the necessary disciplines to answer the questions. So my caution is that we do this in a season and with input from different places. Now, just in closing, I'm going to skip over several things here and move to the theme of the conference, which is science-faith synergy, glorifying God and serving humanity. And when we think about chalices, we think of the Eucharist. The chalice is the cup used to contain the wine consecrated in the Eucharist. And it's played a significant role in holding the wine for centuries. The earliest chalices, in fact, some of them were made of glass. Some are made of clay and glass. The later were made of precious metals, and some form chalices, and even some have had and do have precious stones. The container, though, is not my emphasis, but rather the focus is anchoring the Last Supper in God's redeeming purposes. The communion we share with the Lord in His death and risen life, signified in the bread and wine, addresses the unity of the church. We are one body in Christ, and in belonging to that one body, we do not take the bread and wine simply because the Lord commands us to, although we do that, but because we believe in the participation of this sacrament, which contributes to our growth. Part of our growth in taking the elements of wine and bread, with wine often administered in the chalice, is to reinforce our commitment to the body of Christ and to commit to growth together. And part of that growth is in reconciliation. God is the author of all true reconciliation, and as we mature in Christ, we see several foci of that reconciliation. The restoration of human relationships with God is most crucial. We as fallen humans are in need of God's active work through Christ's atonement in order for Him to restore us to Him. Christ's death restores us to God, and we're justified by the shedding of His blood. As we see, as Paul wrote to the Romans, but God demonstrates His own love for us in this: while we were sinners, Christ died for us. Since we have seen Him justified by His blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through Him? For if, while we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to Him through the death of the Son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through His life? The second part of this has to do with being reconciled to each other. Matthew warns us, if you are offering your gift at the altar, remember that your brother or sister has something against you. Leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to that person, and then come and offer that gift. As a result of God's reconciliation with God, God's work in reconciliation, we have a mandate and love response to be reconciled with other humans and creation, to serve in reconciling roles defined by Micah, who asks, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Those acts of reconciliation have to do with economic, political, and other types of justice, include provide justices to the scientific world, and we can address them through feeding the hungry, treating the sick, providing clean water and air, and nourishing the impoverished. This means that scientists who are Christians can and should share the deep responsibility of stewardship, of management of the earth, and of its atmosphere, and work against, not contribute to, the effects of evil in the world. At that point, I think I'll probably stop just reminding us that the chalice does carry the remembrance of the Lord's Supper, and the reconciling work, the redemptive work through that blood, first is our reconciliation with God, with each other, and then to His creation. And those people that aren't Christians are part of that creation, as are you and as am I. And we have to keep these reconciling works going, whether it is delivering the goods of food, clean water, and so on there. So I thank you very much.
Thank you, Dot. You packed a lot of fascinating information in there. We have, I would say, about 10 or 15 minutes if we want to leave about 10 minutes to saunter down to the dining hall. So we have some time for questions. I think, Dot, you're comfortable just working with the audience to field those questions, and then I'll try to give us some kind of a sense of when we finish up.
Thank you. Sarah. Groaning. You're absolutely correct, and that is part of my point. I cut it off. I actually quoted that passage. I think Sarah's making the point that the creation is groaning, and we are involved in part of that reconciling work to help restore it. And so our work in the stewardship of creation is very important. It's a God-given mandate. And that reconciliation of God's creation to Himself has to do with those works that we do. And that is that third part. If the first is reconciling to us to God, and then to other people, and then to creation, we can't just sit back and say we're going to do works that destroy the creation, but rather we have to do works that help in redeeming it. And part of that's cleaning up waste. Maybe it's cleaning up water systems. In other ways, it's about helping humans, providing food, medicine, and so on to them. Sarah, did I get that right? Okay. Yes. I think you're on to something good. His question has to do with the dispositions that are not toward science may be in part created by Christian reactions to science. Am I hearing that correctly? And I do think the testimony that we have to the public is very important. And so big questions occur then. Can I be a Christian and a scientist? I mean, that's one foundational question there, but there are other questions of testimony of how we've treated the environment. or how we treat each other that also put people off, and so there's not a reckoning there that people can overcome because they don't see those connections that we study and think about and discuss much of the time. I'm going to go down the line here. Yes. That's a great question, and I don't know the answers to that. The question has to do with the role of immigration and inspiring other groups other than American groups to become involved in science in the universities and the government rules that prevent immigrants from participating. Did I get that wrong? No, I hear you. And we are richer because of the immigration and the mix that occurs when you have diversity in your midst and you're studying science. And so there are roadblocks in that pathway right now for other reasons. You've probably been following this. I follow the literature on this a little bit, but there are actually scientists that are blocked from coming here to this country because of their national descent or citizenship. And so we're missing out on the mix of creativity and ideas and exchange that we should have as a science community. I do agree, and we've got a long way to go in terms of policy and changing that so that we can have that rich mix. Sometimes American scientists actually have to go to those countries if those immigrants can't come here. Yeah. Heather. Heather's raising the question that Christians should challenge, I think you're saying, and I agree, or by raising the question, I'm imputing that you would agree that we need to challenge those structures and the things that we're facing to make it better for women and minorities to participate in science or to counteract just the trends. These are just a few. I tried to pick a few that I thought would be of interest to you all. We do need to have a voice, and Particularly, the ASA, look at us, and we have, we're a fairly homogeneous group in some ways. I think we could improve by being much more diverse in our national origins of the individuals that are here. And we're not foreclosing many, many people from joining us, but we're also not reaching out to them. And so I do think there's programming. And there's a voice that we should create for. Sometimes it's as simple as a workshop like the one that Sarah Miles gave at Eastern College a number of years ago. And as I look around the room, I see four or five scientific leaders, women, who are here, maybe in part because of the encouragement that they received from that workshop. I know that you were there, I think, and Susan and Jennifer. Deb Harsma, there were a number of us in that particular setting for several days where women got together and encouraged each other and found their voice together and encouragement. And the age of that group, by the way, extended from a couple of undergraduates, but all the way through. One woman there was 81. So there was a fellowship that occurred among that group, and I think the ASA should be doing that. I think that women aren't the only group, though, that should receive that kind of special mentoring. And I would love to see the fellows, for instance, to have a really active mentoring program. And there's no reason we can't do that. We should create a database that links NGOs, universities, industry together. And we have contacts among us that we could list on that database. And there should be a screening platform where that occurs, where we match up junior scientists. And some of those may be undergraduates. There would be graduate students and many others who could benefit from mentoring, internships, research, contact with. Sometimes it's a week of going and spending a week with someone at a field station. I don't know. The interests are incredibly varied, but we should be a mechanism, in my view, of connecting the dots, connecting the interest with the opportunities that are there. And there's a limit to what we can do because the resources that we have, if you listen to the report last night in terms of our financial resources, but there are creative ways that people can come together, even as the fellows, and create this. I think we could actually do that. So those are two examples. I don't know whether that touches on it. No. Okay. Next. Yes.
I think that the problems that you described are pretty deep and pretty institutionally entrenched. So yeah. It's going to take a lot of effort on a lot of people and a long time to change. But then, I don't know quite how to put this, but looking in the mirror, I noticed my gray hair. And I think a lot of us fail to realize the importance of what one might call integrating over one's career. What I mean by that is that you might not be able to make tremendous big changes, but over years, you do have a lot of influence on a lot of people, and I would encourage people to keep that in mind. And what we as Christians can bring to the table, if I'm not quite aging, is at least the desire to keep our egos out of this. Yeah. What I mean by that is that to be the kind of research advisor where you really care about the students, and then try to then see what's unique about these students and to encourage them to look at different opportunities and not to think very narrowly about roles of ourselves as being the measure of success. I've had some women who I've mentored and just getting to know them. They wanted to, for example, go into, I think, very important careers, not necessarily in research, but in government and public policy. We encourage them to do that. The students wanted to leave the all together and go into biology. So they can just say, no, I just called up to their biology department and they go up to options that are there. And also importantly, this is something that I actually had a conversation with a colleague who said, oh, your latest thesis student with a degree from Arthur Davis University wants to go into high school teaching. Isn't that a waste? And I had a very long conversation about why that isn't. Yeah. So I just throw these out as examples to affirm both the nature of the problem, but what you can do from our Christian perspective to keep on chipping away at it. So not so much a question, but a word of encouragement.
Yeah, thank you. Your observation is excellent. And we're all trying to make a difference one at a time. I have quite a few faculty from Wheaton who are here today, and I know they're encouraging students one by one. I look at Brian Groyles. Is a former student of ours, I'll say, because there are several of us here who taught Brian. He's chair of the department at John Brown. And unfortunately, I don't know all of you and all of your heritage, but I know that somebody must have encouraged you along the way, or you probably wouldn't be here. And it is that one-on-one, and particularly in the graduate setting, where our students, at least, are looking for relationships. And they want to know that what they're doing is making a difference and so on, and certainly true at the undergraduate and many other levels, too.
What more is that?
I see a number of hands. There's one there. Yes.
Mine will be a partial response to the question that was raised that we hear about a low level of education in the United States. I recently got an email from a chemistry professor at Oklahoma Wesleyan University in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, who had just reviewed a textbooks that are being used at his local Wesleyan Christian school, and he described that the tone was generally negative for science. Mm-hmm. And that is endemic in the homeschool environment. So I would be sitting with you asking for advice about what I can do.
Yes. Well, I do think there's room for us to develop materials and to be volunteers to speak to homeschool students, and I hear stories almost every week of people who, and some of them are pretty horrible stories, of the children's experiences in the sciences. And our faculty are very, very open to having people come in and look at some of the exhibits that we have and so on, and to expose students. But we, as members of the ASA, I think, should avail ourselves, and maybe that's part of the network that we should do, is to avail ourselves to present good science to students in our respective communities. This is not an Illinois problem. This is a problem all over the nation and perhaps beyond, where we need to reach out and present science as exciting, as legitimate for Christians, and I think we could develop some materials. This sounds like a very foundational thing, but for the student who's excited about the body or about birds or butterflies or whatever it is, they need to know that's okay. And it's okay to be a Christian and to appreciate that and then to go and to study it. One thing I wanted to point out to you, and I actually overdid this a bit, but you are sitting right now in Naperville, which has the number one science program in the nation. The Naperville High School has the best, most, although the U.S. is way down on that list internationally, you're sitting in the school district that has the number one science program in the nation. Just thought you'd be interested in that. And I wish you could go over to the Naperville High School and see what they're doing. They have some phenomenal teachers over there. Some are Christians. I know some of them, and they're excited about physics. We have a physics chair who's just stepped out of the chairmanship who developed in our school a thing called Physics Fanatics, and they go around and talk to students. They wear green or purple or some kind of, Stuart's partial to purple, but I've seen them in green T-shirts, and they go out and do gee whiz experiments for the public schools, but also for Christian schools. And we're doing that for the homeschools as well. And I know our chemists have done that in the past, and our biologists avail themselves too. We need to make ourselves more available and not be insular on these issues. So you raise a great question. And I do think there's room for us to be more systematic. And maybe the ASA is a good mechanism for doing that. Yeah, I understand.